Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here. We are in Jonah chapter 2, which is an interesting set of verses, an interesting concept. What we've got is a psalm, a thanksgiving psalm that we've got to consider all the options, not all of them, but some of the options are that this is, if you believe the book is just poetic, then this is just kind of like a moment of a little song where everybody starts singing and a little part of a play. Some people like to consider this, someone added it later on into the book to kind of, you know, give it a little poetic sound to it. But what I think we should do is consider it part of the book, part of the story, meaning when the book was put together, this was there. And I'll show you some reasons for that, meaning it's a hinging point. Things don't make sense without this psalm of thanksgiving. I think we should consider the fact that Jonah is the author, that Jonah wrote this. Jonah is a prophet. And if we look back at the prophets in the Old Testament, there was always music involved or often involved, going way back to the days of Saul, Samuel. They were singers. They would prophesy in lyrics. They were trained in phraseology and words. They were familiar with poems. They would often present things in this kind of a format. We can see this with Elisha calling for a harp during one of his prophecies. And so Jonah, if he is a trained prophet, which I think he is a trained prophet, Amos, you can say when he went to that, he's not so much of a trained prophet. In fact, he says, "I my father wasn't a prophet. I'm not a prophet. I'm a herdsman. I'm not trained to do this, but God called me." There was a group that was trained. They went to school of the prophets. Elisha had a school of the prophets. Elijah was involved with it. We can see this on Elijah's being taken to heaven and Elisha going with him and coming back to the school of the prophets. So when we look at this, it is something that helps explain what is going on in here. Is Jonah is trained to express himself with words and poems and phraseology and rhythms and music. That this is something that was his forte. This is, if he's a prophet, this is his gift. This is what he would do. The other thing to notice about this is that it says in chapter 2, verse 1, "From inside the fish, Jonah prayed to the Lord his God, and he said." Now, what we're going to see in this, and this is kind of important to understand as I break this down, is there is going to be three prayers in this poem, in this chapter. There's going to be the prayer of thanksgiving that we're reading. We are reading this prayer right here. This is the prayer we are reading in chapter 2, the prayer of thanksgiving. He prays this, it tells you, inside the fish. He is inside the fish when he's praying this. But during this prayer, and we'll see this early on, I can see it in chapter 1, verse 2. He said, "In my distress, I called to the Lord, and he answered me." That's in this thanksgiving prayer, he's referring back to a prayer, and that is this first prayer right here, his cry for help. Help. He was in distress, and that prayer was answered. This is not the prayer that's recorded here. This prayer of thanksgiving mentions this prayer here. It refers back. This is a prayer in the past. What we're reading is a prayer in the context of this. And as it ends, he's going to talk about, he's going to go to the temple, he's going to make vows, he's going to offer sacrifices, and he's going to have a prayer of thanksgiving or a vow sometime in the future. So, it is possible that what he's got right here, this that we're reading, I'm going to tell you what I think, and again, you're going to have to decide how this all works together, that the prophet in the belly of the fish for 3 days is going to think through this. He's going to compose this. I mean, I've never been in the belly of a fish, but I have been on a long car ride. And you've got time. Now, again, what is his condition? Is he in and out of consciousness? Is he being digested? What is taking place? These things, we don't know a lot about that. But this psalm gives the impression it's being composed at this time in the fish. And because what he's going to realize is he's crying for help as he's sinking, and it's going to be recorded at least twice of the three phases of him going from in the water, sinking through the water, being at the bottom of the water. So the surface, then he's sinking in the darkness, and finally he reaches what is, the roots of the mountain. It's there he calls for help. And at that point, he thinks he's dead. It's over. He's reached the gates of Hades, and all of a sudden, a fish swoops him up. When that fish swoops him up, he doesn't give the impression he's in a panic. It gives the impression in the psalm that he realizes, I've just been delivered from Sheol. A fish has just swallowed me. Thank God, a fish just swallowed me. In other words, his problem was sinking to the bottom of the sea. Being swallowed by a fish was the answer. There's no doubt about that. When you read this, he's not like, oh God, let me out of this fish, I'm going to be digested. Once he hits the fish, as we read this psalm, he knows God answered my prayer. I'm on my way back to the temple. I will see God in his temple again. And so that's why this prayer that we're reading is a prayer of thanksgiving. Although he recounts being in distress, he recounts this prayer's cry for help. This psalm, this chapter, is not him, oh God, please help me. He has already prayed that prayer. The fish swallowed him. And for 3 days and three nights, he's in the belly of a fish. And this is what he is composing. This is what he is thinking. And being a prophet, there's no stretch of the imagination to assume the prophet in this 3 days can organize his thoughts, put it in poetic form, put it in phraseology, and create a psalm of thanksgiving. Now, some could say this is just a general psalm of deliverance, a psalm of thanksgiving. And when you look at the psalms in the book of Psalms, you've got 150 psalms. A lot of them are very, very general in their presentation, meaning anybody who's in a situation where they're crying out for help and they've been delivered from whatever, credit card debt, thank God, any place, any time, if it's delivered from sickness in the 8th century BC, if it's delivered from the enemies, if you're King David, if you're delivered some problem you've got in the modern world, any place, any time, these psalms oftentimes are general enough that they'll fit your circumstances. And what they were used for, they were created by the priests, they were created by David, they were created by Hezekiah's men, some were by Moses, some by unknown authors, but they were collected as psalms that could be used in the temple by the Levites, by the priests, by the worshipers that were coming, and they weren't for necessarily a particular time in history, although they may have come out of a particular time in history. Once they were written, it's like, this is good, they put it in the hymnal. We've had hymnals, and these songs in the hymnal can be sung in the 1700s, the 1800s, you maybe need to update the language, the 1900s, and they can actually be put on, slide projectors or PowerPoints if you actually want to take the time and write all those big words out, or just go with the little boyfriend songs and sing those. But nonetheless, they're like that. They're not designed for something specific. They're used for praise and worshipers. This psalm right here is not one of those. It's written, I'll show you the style that it's written in, but it's written very specific. It's not like Jonah is like, well, let me find a good psalm that I'm familiar with. Oh, this one will work, and plugs it in. This one is written very specific. It's going to be hard for someone else, unless they try to generalize it, to take this and put it in the book of Psalms and say, this is a psalm that can be sung by the worshipers as they're coming up to worship, or if they want to give God a sacrifice or a thanks offering, they can sing this psalm or recite the psalm because it will work anywhere. It's pretty specific when you get into this. It's about being in the ocean or the sea, sinking through the sea, hitting the bottom of the sea, and being delivered. And it talks about seaweed, a variety of things. It's very specific for Jonah. Now, of course, you could adapt it and use it for something else. But this psalm is written by Jonah. It's not beyond his ability to compose a Thanksgiving song in the format that the Hebrews used, because he used them all the time. And he's going to make a vow that he's going to have sacrifices and fulfill his vow, which means he's going to go to the temple. And he may have known, well, he knows, he assumes that once he's in the belly of the fish, it's not, oh, God, now get me out of this. It's not like he jumped from the frying pan into the fire. It's like, oh, get me out of this mess. Oh, no, now I'm in a whale. Oh, no, a fish. Oh, no, it's gotten worse. No, once he's swallowed by the fish, he knows I've just been delivered. God is taking me back somewhere where I'll be able to worship him again in his temple. And so he knows he's going to be in the temple. His inclination is to fulfill his vows. So this psalm of thanksgiving that's being composed is possibly what he's planning on singing, reciting at his time in the temple when he fulfills his vows. He's maybe just doing his homework ahead of time. He's getting his song ready for that time he's back in the temple. So again, there's three prayers in here. The prayer that we're singing or reading is the prayer of thanksgiving that he's writing, composing. Again, he's not writing it out on paper, I wouldn't believe. But he's composing it. He's putting it together in the fish during those 3 days. During this, he looks back at his time of distress in the water when he prays for help, finally. He records that time, and God miraculously answered him by sending the fish. So he mentions this prayer, but he also mentions at the end that because he's been delivered, he knows he's going to be able to fulfill his vows in the future at the temple. And so the prayer will be offered once again there. So there's three prayers in this, and we're looking at the prayer of thanksgiving. And again, it is not a prayer of distress. Let me read it to you right now. I want to go back and break it down in several ways, but here it is. We know what took place. We know Jonah's on the boat. We know he's given them indication that he's the problem. He's ran away from Yahweh, the God of heaven who created the land and the sea. And the men, the pagan sailors, do not want to throw Jonah in. They're not being presented in chapter 1. They're not being presented as barbaric. We'll just kill somebody. We'll offer a sacrifice to the gods. They're like, that doesn't even make sense that we should throw you in the water. If you're innocent, we'll be guilty. This God that created this huge storm, if we kill an innocent man by drowning him, oh my gosh, now what's he going to do to us? They're already terrified of the Lord. We don't want to make him more mad. Let's just try to row to the... Everything's been thrown overboard. They've been trying to get to the shore. Now they know the problem. It's like, oh. And then they pray to the Lord after they try to row. And then finally now the sailors are praying, not to their gods, to Yahweh. Jonah won't pray. The sailors, the pagans, are praying to Yahweh. We're just doing what we think you want. We just understand we're doing what we think you want. And they throw him in the sea. And sure enough, instantly it becomes calm. And now they're terrified. It's like, oh my gosh, we've just come face to face with God. And it says they all fulfilled their vows, which probably indicates at some point in the future, they went to a Yahweh center, maybe Jerusalem, maybe somewhere on the seaports where they had some kind of high place of worship for Yahweh. We don't know for sure, but it says they fulfilled their vows. Now, verse 17, chapter 1, verse 17. Now Jonah's in the water. We'll go back and review this here in this poem. But verse 17, but the Lord provided a great fish to swallow Jonah. Again, it's a fish. It's frustrating to try and figure this out. What kind of a great fish was it? In the Mediterranean Sea, what could it be? I mean, people have gone through all the options. Well, maybe a big old whale came in and swallowed him. Well, a lot of times the whale's mouth isn't big enough. Its throat's not big enough. There's all kinds of issues. No one's got a slam dunk on what this fish is. That shouldn't prevent us from embracing the fact that this says a fish swallowed Jonah. Well, I don't know. Because it is possible. You could always figure out some natural way it took place. And I'm not against that. In fact, I think it was probably very natural. There's probably a fish in the right place, the right time that does this. And this is their behavior. It doesn't have to be some strange, special creation, alien life on the planet. But notice it does say the Lord, Yahweh, provided. Now, that does lead to the fact that he may have put this thing in place. And we may not even, it may be extinct. And that's not, I'm not going to use that as a bailout, but maybe this thing's not even around anymore. We don't know. But he provided this fish. I'm not away from accepting this as a very natural event that the Lord's overseeing. To swallow Jonah. Now notice it swallows him. It doesn't keep him in his mouth. So Jonah has gone into the whale's stomach. That's why he's going to be regurgitated out. He's going to be vomited out. He's not going to be spit out. He's going to be kicked back out of the system. And Jonah was inside the fish 3 days and 3 nights. Now, 3 days and three nights are going to be important. I got to read this, otherwise I'm never going to start. I'll never get through it. Anyway, inside the fish for 3 days and three nights. From inside the fish. Now, that's an important line right there, chapter 2, verse 1, because that tells you where Jonah's at. He has been in the water for however long he can hold his breath, apparently. He's sinking further. Now he's finally at the bottom. Now the fish has swallowed him, and now from inside the fish, Jonah prayed to the Lord his God, and he said. Now, if you just do a surface reading on that, he's swallowed by a fish, and now Jonah prays, Lord, oh God, help me, help me, help me. That's not what happens. From inside the fish, he said, in my distress, I called to the Lord, and he answered me. That's already happened. I was in the water drowning, and it's going to be repeated several times in this psalm. In my distress, I called to the Lord in the past, and he answered me. From the depths of the grave, I called for help, and you listened to my cry. And that means, how did he listen to his cry? In other words, Jonah's saying, I was delivered. How was he delivered? This fish swallowed me. I'm alive. I am alive and conscious in this fish. Now, he doesn't say fish here. Again, let's stop here too. When Jonah gets swallowed by the fish, it's not like he's, you know, snorkeling. And he's saying, oh no, here comes a big fish. And he's trying to get out of the way and he gets swallowed by it. He's in the, we're going to read about it. He's in dark. He's in the bottom. He's at the very bottom of the sea. It's dark. He's not like seeing, analyzing. He's in the final moments of consciousness. He's fading away. His brain waves, he's running out of oxygen. His brain waves are cutting out. And in that moment, again, in that moment, he indicates it here. He didn't pray when the sailors told him to pray. He didn't pray when the Lord, when he says, well, throw me overboard, but first let me confess my sins. Maybe I can pray and God will stop the storm. He's not even talking to the Lord. He's analyzing the Lord. And then they throw him in the water. Now he's sinking. He still doesn't pray. Oh, no, what am I going to do? He's sinking. We're going to read throughout this. He's going to read. And finally, he's going to be at the gates of Hades, the bars of Sheol. We'll talk about that. And it's like, okay, and I'm fading away. I'm losing consciousness. My brain waves are stopping to function. Oh, God, help me. It appears, then he prays, whoosh, and here comes the fish. So he doesn't see the fish coming. He's in darkness. He's hanging on to consciousness, and he gets swallowed by the fish. So understand, when he's writing this, it's not like he knows, could, if we had Jonah here tonight, Jonah, what kind of fish was it? I never saw it. I was on the inside in darkness. Meaning, Jonah, we don't know. You understand what I'm saying? I mean, Jonah doesn't even know possibly. Again, I'm not trying to, I mean, I'm just saying, I'm not trying to build any kind of a case there. It's just like, he's inside this fish. And listen to my cry. He says, you hurled me into the deep, we'll talk about that, into the very heart of the seas, and the currents swirled about me, all your waves and breakers swept over me. I said, I have been banished from your sight. This is Jonah. It's like, it's over. I have been banished from your sight. He has thrown me overboard. He wants nothing to do with me. I am unclean. I've been banished from his sight. Yet, he says, I will look again towards your holy temple. So in other words, I said this, I have been banished, but yet now I know I have not been banished. I've been swallowed by a fish. Yet I will look again towards your holy temple. Notice the leap. He's at the bottom of the sea, swallowed by the fish, and his conclusion is, I'm going back to the temple. This is good news. You're still in the belly of a fish somewhere in the Mediterranean Sea. Yeah, but do you understand what just took place? I was unconscious. I was my brain waves were stopping or were failing. And now I'm in the belly of the whale. I'm fully conscious. I know where God has taken me. He has taken me back to his temple. The engulfing waters threatened me. The deep surrounded me. Seaweed was wrapped around my head. To the roots of the mountain I sank down. The earth beneath barred me. And there's a key word, barred me in forever. Again, that is a direct reference to the bars of Sheol, or what we would say in the New Testament, the gates of Hades, which are the wall, that are the gates of a wall around the city of the underworld, and those are the bars. He says, I was falling into Sheol, and I was going to pass the bars into the gate, the walls, and I would never get out of Sheol. It all fits together. But you brought my life up from the pit. That's the name. That's the word for the name of the city of the underworld in Hades. It just says the pit. It's throughout the Old Testament. O Lord, or Yahweh my God. In other words, I was at the gates of Hades, at the bars of Sheol, never to return, and all of a sudden, you brought me up. When my life was ebbing away, I remembered you, Lord, and my prayer rose to you in your holy temple. And this is that first prayer up here, where it mentioned he prayed. And there it says right here, my life was ebbing away, and now I pray. This was his cry for help that was in the past. That it says, and my prayer rose to you in your holy temple. And then he ends up in verse 8, those who cling to worthless idols forfeit the grace that could be theirs. And that right there, we'll talk about when we get there. But he's referring to basically three groups of people. The sailors, who if they would have clung to their worthless idols, nothing's going to happen. But instead, they embraced Yahweh and they received the grace, they received the covenant love. Israel, that generation of Jonah's time in Israel, or Jonah himself, go away from the Lord after idol worship. They forfeit the grace that could be theirs. Jonah now has received that grace. The sailors turn their backs on the idols and receive grace. Jonah finally received grace from the Lord, and he's headed towards Nineveh, and this is all setting the stage up for Nineveh. He's going to a people in Nineveh who've forsaken the Lord, but they're going to turn to him and receive the same covenant type of grace and forgiveness that the sailors received, that Israel could receive, that Jonah just received, and he's taken this message to Nineveh. In other words, Jonah now is in a position exactly where the Ninevites are. He's no better. He's in the same. He is now at the bottom. He's going to be destroyed, consumed. He cries out for help, and God says, okay, I'll help you. Now, did you see how that happened? It happened to the sailors. They cried out for help. I helped them. You cried out for help. I helped you. I did it to the sailors. I did it for you. Now, go to Nineveh. They're going to cry out for help, and I'm going to help them too. And you would think that he would be ecstatic about this. And he is, because it's referring to himself. But this verse 9 right here, it says, verse 8, those who cling to worthless idols forfeit the grace that could be theirs. But I, like the sailors did, and like Nineveh is going to do, with a song of thanksgiving will sacrifice to you what I have vowed I will make good. And that's exactly what the sailors did. They took vows, they made sacrifices, and they made it good. And then he shouts with a voice, I would say a voice of victory, salvation comes from Yahweh. That's what the sailors realize. Nineveh is going to realize that. And he's shouting this in the belly of a fish. Again, shouting. It's a victorious proclamation. Salvation comes from Yahweh. And verse 10, and the Lord commanded the fish, and it vomited Jonah onto dry land. So there's what we're looking at. Now on page 1 of the notes, point 4, why 3 days and 3 nights? And you know this is going to carry over into Jesus' ministry, because he's going to use this as, just like Jonah, the sign of Jonah will be given. This generation, he says, in 30 AD, will not receive any sign except the sign of Jonah. As Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the fish, so the Son of Man will be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth. And that's a very, very close correlation to this. And here's what this would mean. Why 3 days and 3 nights? Here are some options for this, because it's got to have some meaning. And we've got to kind of go back and find out the meaning. We can't just create it on our own. But here it is, and this is the best I can do so far. That may have been the time needed to return Jonah to the shores of Israel on the Mediterranean coast. So definitely, here is the Mediterranean, here's Israel. And remember, when we say Israel here in this context, Israel is where the presence of the Lord is at, in the temple in Jerusalem. And this is going to be one option. The Lord's presence is in the temple in Jerusalem. But in northern Israel, it could be at the Yahweh high places. Again, it's corrupt. We just read Amos. We know northern Israel is messed up. Their religious system, their synagogue, not synagogues, their temples are paganized. But they're still using the name Yahweh. They're still trying to call themselves the people of Israel. They still got some pieces there. And they may still have Yahweh temples completely paganized. But this may refer to a place that you could go worship Yahweh in a very corrupt fashion. Maybe the sailors went to something like that. There is the temple of God in Jerusalem. That itself has gone through periods of major corruption, so that even kings have had to come in and tear out the pagan Asherah poles that were in the temple and the Baal stones. it's gone pagan. So, you know, it's always a problem. But the presence of the Lord is here. Jonah is in the, I want to draw a fish right here, but I don't think I could even draw a fish. See right there? It looks like a goldfish cracker. Okay, he's in there. He's in this fish, okay? Now, he's in the fish. It's going to take 3 days, 3 nights to get him back to Israel. That's the key. He's at the bottom of the sea. He gets swallowed. And 3 days later, again, we don't know. Maybe he just wants Jonah in the belly of the fish for 3 days. Jonah, the whales or the fish just taking laps around the Mediterranean Sea. Did he take the most direct route? Did he follow the currents? Did he stop and get something to eat on the way? Is he with a school of fish? We could assume at least that this fish from point A to point B took him 3 days to get there. So that's at least getting him to the land of Israel. What he did in between there, we don't know. The other thing, this psalm specific, I'm back up to point 4B. A person is considered truly dead after 3 days and three nights. That's part of the reason why Jesus was in the grave for 3 days. He's definitely dead 3 days and three nights. That's kind of a traditional way of thinking about it. And in their thinking at this time, if you're going to go to the underworld, if you're going to go to Sheol, here's the waters. Now you're in the water. Here's Jonah. He's in the water. Jonah's sinking now. He's sinking in the water. Okay, he's surrounded. And now down here is the bottom down here. This is where the bars, the gates of Hades were, because once you pass through these gates now, you're in Hades. Now he's going to be right down here next to the gates of Hades. In the ancient world, it took you, in different stories, I'm going to read some more to you here in a minute, it took you 3 days to go to Hades, to go to Sheol, to go to the underworld. It was a three-day journey to get here. Now, in Jonah's case, I don't think it took him 3 days to get to the bottom of the Mediterranean Sea. I think it took him whatever breath he's got in his lungs before he hit the bottom, it would appear. But that also takes them 3 days to get back to the land of, forget Israel now, just the land of the living. So what the point there is, Hades, Sheol, the underworld, in the ancient Middle East was a three-day journey away. And if you somehow broke out, it's going to take you 3 days to get back to the land of the living, which all of a sudden, ding, 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 the whole Jesus being in the heart of the earth for 3 days and three nights fits with that understanding. Now, again, are we talking a measurable, literal 3 days in some scientific world that the Western world would want to experience so we can measure it and calculate it? I don't even understand how that would relate. Point C, it requires a three-day journey to reach Sheol. This is recorded in Amorite and Babylonian documents. And when we say Amorites, we're talking about the Amorites in Syria. You know where Syria's at? If this is Israel, Syria's right up here. In this Syrian culture, the Aramean culture, they in their writings, we can read it today, they talk about Sheol being 3 days away. Babylon, over where the Assyrians are at, where Nineveh's at, Sheol's 3 days away. Point D, in context, 3 days was the time Jonah spent in the belly of the fish being transported from the bottom of the Mediterranean Sea back to the coast of Israel, or from the gates of Sheol back to the presence of the Lord. This matches the understanding of the ancient Middle Eastern cultures that it takes 3 days to travel back from Sheol to the land of the living. So in other words, it's in our story, and it matches the Syrian writings, it matches Babylonian writings, it matches what Jesus said. Now again, I'm not talking science here, I'm not talking Western world, we're going to measure this, we're talking what that means. I'm saying this fish brought Jonah back from Sheol, and it took him 3 days to get him back. Now again, if you just want to say it took him 3 days to get back to Israel, that's what we're looking at here, and it all fits. So that's one of the reasons why it's 3 days and three nights. Point five, Jonah's inside the fish, and all this is taking place, and you can see right there, I write, he doesn't get to view the fish, he doesn't see the fish coming in the darkness, even when the fish vomits up onto the land. I mean, he's being regurgitated out with all the stuff that's being regurgitated out. I mean, the fish isn't going to, like, you know, give a, you know, a glancing goodbye to him or something. Maybe they wave goodbye. It's like he's regurgitated up onto the shore and the fish is gone. I mean, if you ever had a fish jump off of a hook right after you try to reel, it's gone. It's like you see a splash and it's gone. So Jonah may have never gotten a look at this fish. So, you know, he doesn't know. Number six. This psalm is from the belly of the fish and must be Jonah's own words. I've already said several of these things, very specific in nature. Its application is useless if he's going to take it and somebody else is going to use it because it's so specific. Point C, the psalm of chapter 2 cannot be removed from this book. Some people have said, and I'm talking about the early critic, not the critic, but when you start reading the commentaries, the critics start ripping it apart. Well, someone added this later, but the reason this can't have been added later is just added to the story because it records the deliverance of Jonah. There's so many things missing if this chapter wasn't there. The context of the sailors, of the people of Nineveh, all of it is explained in this chapter. Jonah has a change of heart somewhere in this book, and if this chapter's gone, it makes no sense. Jonah's time in the fish will be left to the reader's own imagination, and much of it still is. But we do know from this poem, this psalm in chapter 2, Jonah's time in the fish included him being thankful that he's in the fish. The fish was considered to be deliverance. Jonah was conscious in the fish. Jonah was hopeful and expressing thankfulness in the fish. Jonah was anticipating deliverance to the temple while he's in the fish. We know that because of what's in this. Now again, was he being... I'm the one that wants to know. Was he being digested? Had the digestive process began? I mean, was he hearing gurgling? Were there other fish in the fish? I mean, what was it? I mean, these are things I want to know. I want to know that here's what I want to know. If he got regurgitated out after 3 days, when he came out, what did he look like? I mean, was he bleached? I mean, was his hair gone? Was his skin completely smooth and it's got a bleached look to him? How did his eyes survive? Did his eyes survive, or was his sight hindered from that? So that, I mean, does that help when he goes into Nineveh, walks into Nineveh, you know, and the guy's been in the belly of a fish for 3 days? We already know from 765, they've had a plague, they've had rebellion, they've had a solar eclipse, they've been hit with an earthquake, they've got another rebellion and another plague, and then in walks Jonah. He looks like death warmed over, and it's like, and it's clear this guy's been somewhere. Yeah, I've been to hell and back, and I've got a message from God. Please tell us. You know, and it's like, it's one thing to fly in on your own private jet all dressed up in a 3-piece suit, talk about God wants to bless you. It's another thing to crawl out of the belly of a whale and go, repent, because God's going to destroy your city in 40 days. How do you know? I just got back from the underworld. Please. I mean, it may change the story. I can't say that because it doesn't tell you. And in his bleached appearance with no hair and scaly little eyes, he walked in and sweated what was left of his voice. God's going to destroy you. It doesn't say that. It'd be a great scene in the movie, but it doesn't say that. I want to know if that's the case. Okay, next page. Now here's, I really want to get through this tonight, but I did this right here. What you've got right there is a chart, and it helps you see what's going on right here. And I'm going to do this now, is I've already drawn it up here on the board. We're going to draw the top of the sea. We're going to call sinking in the middle of the sea. And then we're going to say the bottom. And at the bottom is where we're going to see Sheol. We're going to see the phrase the pit, which is the name of the city in the underworld, where the god, what is his name? Mot, the god of the Assyrian, Aramean, not Aramean, but Aramaic god, Mot, is living in the city of Pit. He's the god of Sheol. It's going to be called the roots of the mountains, the roots of the mountains. And Jonah's going to go through these different levels. So here we go. Chapter 2, verse 1. You can see what it says, verse, the text, and the location, the focus. Jonah prayed to the Lord his God from the belly of the fish. This is inside the fish after having sunk through the water to the bottom. He's now in the bottom. Jonah prays this prayer inside the fish, which will include recount Jonah's experience in the water, his approach to death and Sheol, recount his cry for help, his thanksgiving for being delivered from Sheol, and include his vow he intends to fulfill at the temple. So chapter 2, verse 2, there's two things here. I called out to the Lord out of my distress, and he answered me. This would have taken place at the bottom. This is where he prays in his distress. Out of the belly of Sheol I cried, and you heard my voice. He's at the bottom, and the belly of, not the belly of the fish, the belly of Sheol. So the belly of the fish is not the belly of Sheol. He's in the belly of Sheol, and the belly of the fish is going to deliver him from the belly of Sheol. I cried, and you heard my voice. And how does he know God heard his voice? He gets swallowed. Now, chapter 2, verse 3. Now he's going to record. You can see the sinking right here in chapter 2, verse 3. For you cast me into the deep, into the heart of the seas. That's up here. You cast me into the deep. He's in the sea. And the flood surrounded me. Now he's sinking. Now he's, the flood surrounded me. And when he talks about the flood, that's the waters of the deep. The flood surrounded me. All your waves and billows passed over me. Now he's down here again at the bottom. He's gone top, middle, bottom. And now everything's moving over him. Here he's surrounded by him. Now they're all moving over him, all the currents, all the waves, everything's over him. All your waves and billows passed over me. Now he's at the gates of Sheol. He's in the bottom of the ocean, at the roots of the mountain. All these are terms he's going to use. He's going to say this all again in another fashion. He says, and then I said, at that point when he's at the bottom, he realizes it's over. And then I said, I am driven away from your sight. Jonah realizes it's over. He realizes God has cast him from his presence. He's never coming back. But yet something happened. Now, it doesn't tell you what happens right there. Later on, it's going to tell you that's where he cries out for help. So he says, I'm driven away from your sight is what I said, yet I shall look again at your holy temple. But wait, once I got here, there was deliverance. I am on my way back. I'm on my way back to the presence of the Lord. So you see the contrast. I'm being driven from your sight, but wait, something happened. I will again be in your holy temple. Now, chapter 2, verse 5. We're going to say it all again. If you don't mind, here we say it again. Chapter 2, verse 5. The waters closed in over me to take my life. The deep surrounded me. So now he's back at the top. He's going to say it again. He says, here's what happened. I was surrounded by the waters. Then, chapter 2, verse 5, seaweed wrapped around about my head. Now he's singing through the waters again. Here's seaweed wrapped around his head. He's being encased. He's being all the trouble he's going through. And then chapter 2, verse 5, at the roots of the mountain. Now he's at the bottom. He went through the hole. I was cast in, the seaweed around my head. Now I'm at the roots of the mountain, which is right back at the same place, the bottom, Sheol, the gates of Hades, the pit. I went down at the roots of the bottom. Chapter 2, verse 6, I went down to the land whose bars closed upon me forever. And down to the land, which land? The land of the underworld. Whose bars, there's your bars of the wall, the bars of the gate, the bars of the city, closed upon me forever. He was entering the bars of Sheol, or the gates of Hades, and when they go closed, it's over. Yet, once he's at the gates of Hades, at the bars, he says, yet you brought up my life from the pit. And that is the Hebrew word that is the name of the city of the underworld. It's translated pit, but it's the name of the city. O Lord, my God. So again, you can see two times he's been at the top, sinking, and at the bottom. And both times when he's at the gates, he's delivered, and he's said it two times now. Chapter 2, verse 7. When my life was fainting, now he explains what happened when he got to Sheol. When my life was fainting away. He's in his final moments. His oxygen's running out. His brain's starting to fail. At that point, again, this is, again, if you want to call it comedy, if you want to call it irony, he could have prayed this prayer when he was asleep on the ship. He could have prayed this prayer when the captain woke him up and told him to pray this prayer. He could have prayed this prayer instead of explaining to the sailors what was going on and all the theology behind the situation. He could have just said, just a minute, let me just pray. Let me just confess. Let me just get right with God here and fix it. He could have prayed all the way through this whole thing. But now he's realizing, I'm about to go into Sheol, and I'm not sure what it would feel like, but you know, he's losing his oxygen. He says, when my life was fading away, I remembered the Lord. It's like, oh, wow, what a great man. No, it's like, well, why why then? Why not just listen to him when he said, go to Nineveh? Why you go? I mean, you're about ready to die. I remember the Lord. It's like a deathbed confession, if you want to say. I mean, it's beyond deathbed. You are already like knocking on the doors of hell or Hades. I remember the Lord, and guess what? And my prayer came to you into your holy temple. Now, probably here, and we'll see this in the notes, this holy temple, we got the temple in Jerusalem, where the presence of the Lord is in Jerusalem. But this temple is probably referring to the heavenly temple. And it's not really a stretch because the throne in heaven, heaven is his throne and earth is his footstool. So sometimes the throne is in heaven, but the footstool's on the earth. And so it's almost as if God's temples are connected with his presence. And so this, again, we can talk about that as we go through. But the point here is he's at the gates of Hades. And when he prays, his prayer reaches the throne of heaven, the throne in heaven, and God answers him immediately with the fish. And now his conclusion, his theological point. Those who pay regard to vain idols forsake their hope of steadfast love. So in other words, what Jonah's saying, what I experienced here is available to everyone. If you will go to Yahweh, and what did he say? Look how bad he's been. Look how bad the situation. And yet in that situation, at the gates of Hades, in his final moments, his brainwaves are starting to falter. It's like, Lord, help! Boom! It reached heaven, and I was delivered. If you're going to cling to an idol right here, you're forfeiting the grace, it sometimes translates here, or here, the better translation here, steadfast love. The covenant faithfulness that God has for you. If you'll cry to him, he'll make a covenant with you right there and he will deliver you. You're in a covenant with him. That's what the sailors got. That's what Nineveh's going to get. That's what Jonah's now experiencing. The whole book is about that, except for the fact when Jonah goes to Nineveh, it's like he's not very happy that they get the same opportunity he got. But then he goes on now, chapter 2, verse 9 on page 3, but with the voice of thanksgiving will I sacrifice to you. What I have vowed, I will pay. Salvation belongs to the Lord. In other words, at this point, he cries out. He said, if I hadn't cried out, I would have forfeited the grace or the covenant that could have been mine. But I was delivered, and now I'm going to, with my voice of thanksgiving, probably this psalm is going to be sung in the temple courts. He's going to bring a sacrifice. He's going to complete his vows and say, salvation belongs to the Lord. Chapter 2, verse 10, that'll be 3 days later. And the Lord spoke to the fish, and it vomited Jonah out upon the dry land. And then we're going to get chapter 3 next week, where it's like he's going to have, it's like, you're delivered, but you're not delivered from your ministry. Go to Nineveh. It's like, and so then it's just ironic how the book ends with Jonah being so negative. You think, you know, again, this is the positive part of the book. This is the part where Jonah is like, finally, you're in the right place. Again, I have now got about 6 pages of notes, so hang on. Chapter 2, verse 1, page 3. With that background that you know, what we see in chapter 2, verse 1, you can see on in your Bibles what verse we're talking about. The Jonah prayed to the Lord his God from the belly of the fish. It was a prayer of thanksgiving, not the prayer of deliverance. It's recording, remembering that. There are 4 typical elements of a psalm focused on thanksgiving. And if you go to the book of Psalm, or any time in the Bible you see this, this is what they would look like. There's an introductory summary of the answered prayer. Chapter 2, verse 2 is what you see. My prayer was answered. Then reports of the personal crisis. That's chapter 2, verses 3 through 6, where he retells, I was at the top, I was sinking, and I was at the bottom. I tell you again, I was at the top, I was sinking, and now I'm at the roots of the mountain. It's bad. I'm knocking on the doors of Sheol. And then the divine rescue is recognized in chapter 2, verse 7. And then the Lord delivered me from the gates of Sheol. And again, you can't get a better deliverance story. You've got people being delivered throughout the Bible. But you've got Jonah at the gates of Hades, at Sheol. And God is answering. I mean, if anything, there's so many things you could do. You could preach this at a revival meeting. I mean, how bad are you? I mean, Jonah was at a rebellious prophet of God, walked away from God, is at the gates of Sheol, ready to just pass away into the gates of Hades. And he calls on the Lord, and the Lord answers from heaven and delivers him and brings him right back to where he was. Okay, and then it ends, they always end with a vow of praise, chapter 2, verses 8 and 9. So you see it's a typical, it matches the formula, which means this poem, this psalm of thanksgiving is intentional. It's written by a professional. It's written by someone who knows how to write this kind of liturgy, which would match Jonah's ability. That's what he's been trained to do. Chapter 2, verse 2, saying, I called out to the Lord out of my distress. He answered me. Out of the belly of Sheol I cried, and you heard my voice. Jonah recalls his first prayer. The prayer was answered by God. Chapter 2, verse 3, for you cast me into the deep. Now remember that word deep there in just a moment. Into the heart of the seas, and the floods surrounded me, and your waves and billows passed over me. And that's the sinking. You get three phases of sinking. Cast into the sea, or the deep. Into the heart of the sea, and I was flood surrounded me as he's sinking. And finally, he's at the bottom, and the waves are passing over him. The Lord is considered the ultimate response. Okay, yeah. You cast me into the sea. Now, we know the story. The Lord didn't reach out and push Jonah overboard. But as I explain here, it was the Lord's responsibility. The Lord is the one who got Jonah into the sea. Once Jonah got on that boat, Jonah's going to go into the sea one way or the other. Just like Israel's coming out of Egypt, one way or the other, Pharaoh, my hand is going to bring them into the wilderness. And here we go. The first prayer that they made, the sailors, they tried to get away. They prayed to their gods and then to the Lord himself, and that didn't work. Then they, by man's own power, they tried rowing to shore. That didn't help. And then finally they say, well, you know, Lord, whatever, we're going to do this thing. And they threw him in. So like my last line on page 4, that point C at the top, my last line there. Although the Lord did not reach down and throw Jonah into the sea himself, the Lord did force the situation to occur. Once Jonah gets on that boat, God is not going to accept anything else except Jonah in the sea. I'm not going to let you row to the shore. I mean, what's wrong with that? We're going to row to the shore and let Jonah get off. No, I want Jonah in the sea. And the storm just got worse. They said, we don't want to throw him in the sea. And finally they said, okay, and they threw him in. So the Lord did cause it to happen. Chapter 2, verse 4 on page 4. Then I said, I am driven away from your sight, yet I shall again look upon your holy temple. Two phases there. He realizes I'm abandoned. And I explained that's banished from the Lord's presence. It means you've been disqualified. It's an actual term that's used for being unclean, unholy, unworthy of entering the temple worship. You're disqualified for some reason. Jonah had become disqualified. You're disqualified from entering the Lord's presence. And being swallowed by the fish was Jonah's deliverance. Deliverance of the fish gave Jonah hope. And once he's swallowed by the fish, he knows, like I said, he's going to the temple. And that temple could be the temple in Jerusalem. It could be a place in Bethel or Samaria somewhere. The very fact that the Lord did not let Jonah die at the bottom gives Jonah the indication that God's not done with me yet. Chapter 2, verse 5. The waters closed in over to take my life. The deep surrounded me. Weeds were wrapped around my head. Notice again the word deep. That's the second time we've heard that. That's point 2 under chapter 2, verse 5. Deep is the Hebrew word tahom, which refers to the primeval ocean, the primeval flood. Now, when I talk about that, now understand this. We've got Genesis chapter 1, verse 2, and we've got Genesis chapter 6 and 7 of the Noah's flood. There was a flood right here. The whole world was covered with water in Genesis, and it says that very clearly. There was a flood. There was a flood here where the earth was once again covered, so we're talking about two floods. This word right here is used to refer to this flood right here, the waters that covered the earth. And I've got two examples of it written there, Genesis 1, 2 and Psalms 104:6, which is talking about the days of creation. And it's the water that surrounded and covered the entire earth. It's the basic elements of the earth. And Jonah, that is, again, what the chaos that covered the earth. Jonah finds himself in this uncontrolled state of sinking. And so the deep, that again, this one, the reason I'm saying that is this deep plays right into the concept of Sheol or Hades, the underworld. This is, again, the place of chaos. In chapter 2, verse 6, at the roots of the mountains, I went down to the land whose bars, again, that's important, the word bars, whose bars closed upon me forever. And those bars are, again, a reference to something, not a sandbar, but like a jail bars, you know, or city bars, or the bars of a gate. That's what it's referring to. Yet you brought me my life up from the pit. And again, the word pit, we'll see that. And if you turn the page, The word pit is the name of the city in the underworld. Now, here what we have, it's the same item, these three pictures. It's a Babylonian steel, which is actually a boundary marker. It comes from, you can see up here, it comes around 1400 BC. It was from Syria. Babylon. It's from Babylon. And I'm going to refer to some Syrian text. But what you see, if you look at that, any one of those pictures, you can see you've got up above, you've got the top is the area of the gods. Then you've got the area below it, you know, that some animals or things. That's the earth. That's the land of the living. And then below that, you've got pillars and you've got a wall. Can you see the pillars? It's the majority of the stele is the pillars and then a wall. Do you see what I'm talking about? It looks like this kind of. You can see you've got the capitals of the pillars right here and coming down like this. You got another one maybe over here. And then you got in between there, you've got a wall going across there like this. Then up above here, you've got those two layers. You're going to have the first layer right here, and that would be the heavens. Then you've got this area here with some activity. That's the earth, the land of the living. And then right below, well, actually, these continue all the way up to here. So we'll have to make this come down to here like this. And then this is Sheol. This is the underworld. So you can see right there the bars, the pillars. And then on two of the images, you can see the serpent. There's a serpent down here circling around this place down here. So now none of this is biblical. This is just the ancient Near East. So that's what they saw. When Jonah's writing, this is the culture that he's speaking to or that he's coming from. Now again, he's a prophet. They've got the Bible. They've got Revelation. But the biblical revelation is not much different than what you see here. I'm going to read through these A through H. In the ancient Near East, there was the understanding that there were gates to the underworld, Sheol or the netherworld. The ancient world view considered the underworld a city with walls and gates. Now understand, as I'm reading this, I've got it written down here at the bottom of this page, point H. Just remember Matthew 16, verse 18. Jesus tells them, "I am going to build my church, and the gates of Hades will not prevail against it." Now, in the context, there's really no other way of understanding that. In the context, he's going to build his church based on his resurrection. I'm going to build a people that's based on the fact that I am resurrected and so are they. And the gates of Hades, the bars of Sheol, the underworld, will not be able to stand against it. In other words, Jonah talks about going in here and not being able to get out. And people always died and went to the underworld. David talks about going to Sheol. Jesus says, "I'm going to build my church, and there's nothing these gates can do to prevent. My church is going to be basically resurrected. You will overcome death." And you can make all the applications you want to, but in context, he's going to go to Hades. He's going to have paid the price. And when he comes out, he's got the keys. It says in Revelations, "I've got the keys of death and Hades. I've got the keys of these gates. What can I do? I've unlocked them. I've broken down the walls." So anyway, that all fits into this. Point C at the top, in Ugaritic literature, which is basically a dialect of the Amorite culture in Syria, or the Arameans, the word right there, pit, H-M-R-Y, is the city of Mot, M-O-T, which is the god of the underworld, which may be that snake that's crawling around down there. That may be a reference to Mot in his city of the pit in the underworld. The Old Testament identifies the city in Sheol with gates. Here's Job chapter 38, verse 16 and 18. God asked Job, "Have you entered into the springs of the sea?" When he says that, he's talking about where the springs, the water comes from up inside the earth. "Or walked in the recesses of the deep?" That's where Jonah fell to. "Have the gates of death," or Sheol, "been revealed to you, or have you seen the gates of deep darkness?" So God right there is playing right into that image of the gates of Sheol and the underworld. Isaiah 38:10. "I said in the middle of my days, I must depart. I am consigned to the gates of Sheol for the rest of my years." That's Hezekiah having rebelled, and now he's got a disease, and he's praying, confessing his sin. And he's asking God not to send him to or consign him to the gates of Sheol, which that's what you see on this image. That's what Jonah's referring to. That's what Jesus says. The gates of Hades will not prevail against you. An unfinished Babylonian boundary marker, that's what we're looking at right there. That's what we see right there. Point E describes what you're looking at. It's from 1100 B.C. Jonah apparently saw these bars, these walls, these gates at point F, point G. Jonah considered himself to have arrived at the gates of Sheol or the bars of the underworld. Turning the page, page 6. The pit, I have the same thing pointed out right there in number or letter A and B. Ezekiel 28:8 mentions, they shall thrust you down into the pit, and you shall die the death of the slain in the heart of the seas. Sheol, Hades, underworld, in Isaiah 14 and Isaiah 38, we've got this. In Isaiah 14, that's talking about apparently the ruler of Tyre or Satan being cast down. It says the realm of the dead below is all astir. Now, this is what it would be like if you want a biblical discussion of what it's like to leave the land of the living and enter into Sheol, enter into the underworld, to pass through the gates of Hades, the bars of Sheol. This is Isaiah the prophet recording the words of the Lord. The realm of the dead below is all astir. There's consciousness in that. People don't die and cease to think. They die and cease to be relevant. They die and their existence is but a shadow. They are destined to live there. And here it is. The realm of the dead below is all astir to meet you at your coming. It rouses the spirits of the departed. Those that have gone to Sheol ahead of you, they're roused to greet you because someone that was a world history participant is entering. They want to see you. They know what's going on. It rouses the spirits of the departed to greet you. All those who were leaders in the world, they come to see the next leader that's going to enter into Sheol. It makes them rise from their thrones. All those who were kings over the nations, they're no longer the kings. They're now in Sheol. They will all respond. They will say to you, you also have become weak as we are. You have become like us. A moment ago, you were powerful in the land of the living. So are we one day. But now we are down here, this is a mere shadow of our existence, and now you too have joined us here in the underworld. All your pomp has been brought down to the grave, which would be the word Sheol, along with the noise of your harps. Maggots are spread out beneath you, and worms cover you. Now, where do you think Jesus gets the concept when he says the worm never dies? There's your verse right there. It's like, well, he was just making something up. It's like, now, he's reading this literally. You go down into the shadowy darkness and that you just continue to fade away forever. Isaiah 38, this is Hezekiah thanking God and praying. And again, you can read that, but he's been delivered. I'm going to read halfway through it. It says, behold, it was for my welfare that I had great bitterness, but in love you have delivered my life from the pit. There's that same word, of destruction. For you have cast all my sins behind your back. For Sheol does not thank you. Death does not praise you. Those who go into the pit do not hope for your faithfulness. So he mentions death, Sheol, and the pit, all as being a place of you're no longer able to respond. You're cut out of any kind of response to the Lord. Chapter 2, verse 7, about on page 6, when my life was fading away, I remembered the Lord and my prayer came to you into the holy temple. Again, I write the same thing I've said before. Consciousness was fading. He remembered the Lord. He prayed. Your holy temple probably refers to heaven. There I got in point C on page 7, I have the references where the heaven is the throne and the earth is the footstool, which connects that whole thing. I've got a quote from a scholar there that kind of makes that connection complete. From just outside the gates of Hades, Jonah prays, chapter 2, verse 8, those who pray regard to vain idols forsake their hope of the steadfast love. I've explained that right there where if you continue the idols, you're forsaking this great deliverance that God can bring you up out of the gates of Hades. But if you stick with idols, you're going to join those inside Sheol, which is a mere shadow of your existence, although you're conscious and suffering. Chapter 2, verse 9, but I, with a voice of thanksgiving, I will sacrifice. You see three things. Point 2, three prayers of Jonah, the vow. Normally a vow was some material gift, so that vow would not just be, I'm going to say something nice, but you'd actually bring some kind of a gift to the god. In the case of the Israelites, they'd bring a sacrifice or an offering, a grain offering, a drink offering, something that would be in line with correctly with the law of Moses. This vow is not to be understood as Jonah repenting of his disobedience. There's nothing in here of Jonah repenting and saying, I'm sorry, I was wrong. It's him asking for deliverance and receiving deliverance and saying, I'm going to come pay homage to the Lord. Jonah likely vowed a gift of thanksgiving to the Lord for having been spared a certain death, and that psalm that we just read here is probably going to be part of it. Three prayers of Jonah, I referred to that earlier, are mentioned in this. Point three, it is possible that the prayer of thanksgiving in chapter that we read is going to be sung or presented in the temple. That's why we've got it written down. You say, well, how could we have something recorded from the, if he wrote it in the belly of the whale or in the fish? It's like, well, because he planned on publishing it. He planned on using it with his vows. It makes complete sense. And then finally, in the fish, he announces the victorious shout, salvation belongs to the Lord, or salvation belongs to Yahweh. He's still in the fish. He may still be 3 days away from deliverance. And Jonah 2:10, and the Lord spoke to the fish and vomited Jonah upon the land. And that's been 3 days and three nights of this. So he's had plenty of time to memorize his song. We know Jonah's not in the mouth of the fish's mouth, that he was swallowed. And I've got point four, several questions I've got, that remain unanswered. Parallels between Jonah and the sailors, and also include Nineveh. Both faced the crisis at sea. Both cried to Yahweh. Both were physically delivered, and both made vows, and apparently went somewhere to keep their vows. Because Jonah's observation of the pagan sailors, and because of Jonah's own personal experience, he is now ready to enter Nineveh. He saw what took place with the sailors. He had it happen to himself. He's in the same position Nineveh is. You've rebelled. You're at the gates of destruction, and the Lord is offering a way out. Now take this message to Nineveh. So right here, he should be able to, number one, understand the people of Nineveh. He should be able to sympathize with the people of Nineveh. He should be able to anticipate the positive response the people of Nineveh are going to have. He should rejoice for sparing the people of Nineveh. He should fearfully worship a God who can turn his wrath, God's wrath, into mercy and covenant blessing. And he should reconsider his invitation or command to preach the people of Nineveh. But Jonah, when he gets there, will be angry. And so this is a very happy chapter in the book of victory and deliverance, but yet it's clouded by the fact that where it's going to go is going to be to a miserable ending of this book, which again fits this book of being exactly the opposite of what you thought. With that kind of a glory, think of David or Hezekiah or one of the apostles with this kind of an event in their life, what they would have just lit the world up with it. And Jonah goes and he's like, when God begins to manifest this in other people's lives, it's like he gets angry. He's more concerned about his tree. A guy that just got out of the belly of a fish, had been delivered from Sheol within a few weeks, is going to be upset because he doesn't have enough shade on earth. It's like, how ridiculous can that get? So again, we got some more ridiculous things taking place here in the book. Thank you for being here. I'll pray, and you're free to go, of course. Father, do thank you again for this chance to look into these things. We thank you for the great deliverance you've offered to all mankind. We ask that we may understand that and continue to daily embrace your hope and the deliverance you have for us. When we find ourselves challenged with obstacles or our own rebellion, that we know that we can turn back to you and you will hear from your heavenly throne and lead us to a place that we can walk with you again and achieve the things you've called us to. Again, we thank you for this opportunity to read these things. We pray for our nation. We pray for the culture that we are in right now, that we may see deliverance, that people may turn to you. And we ask that we may be part of that to bring a voice of victory and a voice of hope through you. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your time.